From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, remembering Elvis. It's now or never. Tomorrow marks the 20th anniversary of Elvis Presley's death. We go to our archives to hear from Peter Guralnick, who's written Volume 1 of a two-part biography of Elvis. Also, we talk with DJ Fontana, Elvis's drummer for many years, and Scotty Moore, Elvis's first guitarist and manager. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. It's not new. My love won't wait. When I first saw you, with your smile so tender, my heart was captured. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Negotiators for the Teamsters Union and United Parcel Service resume talking today in Washington. They have been holding separate meetings with a federal mediator, who then shuttled between the groups. A spokesman for the mediators described today's new talks as serious, but no one is claiming hard progress. The strike is now in its 12th day. The three-man crew of Mir has completed a brief sojourn outside the space station in a small capsule. From Moscow, NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
Mir's two newly arrived cosmonauts and American Michael Foll boarded their Soyuz space capsule and flew from one side of the station to the other. Foll spent the flight videotaping the Spectre Science Module, which had been his home until it was hit by a cargo ship in June. The crew also took still photos in an effort to get a clearer look at the damage caused by that accident. Officials have been able to see a crumpled solar panel on Spectre, but they also want to see the damage that allowed the module's air to leak out. After the flight, which took less than an hour, the crew carefully redocked the Soyuz at a port right next to Spectre. Next week, one cosmonaut plans to enter the airless module itself, which used to supply about half of Mir's electricity before it was sealed off. That internal spacewalk will attempt to reconnect electricity cables to Spectre. I'm Andy Bowers in Moscow.
More than 60 Asian immigrants discovered earlier this week on a rickety boat south of San Diego, California, remain at sea while U.S. authorities decide their fate. From member station KPBS in San Diego, Carrie Kahn reports.
A U.S. Coast Guard cutter is providing food, water, and provisions to the 69 men, women, and children on the vessel. Coast Guard officials boarded the boat Wednesday in international water some 100 miles south of San Diego off the coast of Ensenada, Mexico. Coast Guard Lieutenant Lisa Blau says the passengers' fate is uncertain.
As far as where they're going to end up going, we have no idea until we find out where they're from and the registry of the vessel.
U.S. State Department and immigration officials are assisting in the investigation. Earlier reports stated the immigrants were from China, but officials say the passengers are giving conflicting information and the dilapidated vessel was flying a Mexican flag. 4 years ago, more than 600 undocumented Chinese were intercepted in the same international waters. For National Public Radio, I'm Carrie Kahn in San Diego.
Residents of Redford, Texas are angry over a grand jury's decision not to indict a Marine who shot a local teenager to death. The slaying of the 18-year-old goat herder occurred during an anti-drug surveillance operation last May. The military says the shooting was in self-defense, but civilian authorities say their findings don't agree, as the young man was shot in the back. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down more than 75 points at 7,866. Trading is heavy. The Nasdaq is off 6.5 points at 1,580. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, it's been another day of volatile trading on Wall Street. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
The market is being roiled by concern about a slowdown in corporate profit growth. Shares in Gillette are weaker after the company's earnings expectations were lowered at Merrill Lynch and Payne Webber. Pep Boys has dropped after the auto parts retailer reported disappointing quarterly results, and Reader's Digest Association has fallen after issuing a profit warning. Investors are also troubled by instability in Treasury bond prices, which has occurred on weakness in the dollar. The dollar fell to a three-week low against the German mark this morning, on the view that the Bundesbank has adopted a bias toward raising interest rates. I'm Doug Krisner.
Bell Atlantic and 9X are speedily completing their gigantic merger. The phone companies have crossed the last bridge in the $25 billion merger now that the Federal Communications Commission has given its approval. The new operation, also called Bell Atlantic, is the second largest phone company in the country behind AT&T. It will control 40 million phone lines from Maine to Virginia. General Motors faces another strike. The United Auto Workers says it'll walk out at two transmission plants near Detroit if no contract is agreed to by midnight. The two plants produce transmissions for nearly every GM assembly plant in North America. The union says outstanding issues are the same as those that sparked strikes at six other GM plants this year. Delta Airlines has chosen utility executive Leo Mullen as its new president and chief executive officer. Delta's choice is the first time the carrier has named a new CEO from outside its own headquarters. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach with over 160 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Tomorrow marks the 20th anniversary of Elvis Presley's death. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we pay tribute to the king of rock and roll. Our guest is Peter Guralnick, author of The Last Train to Memphis, which may be the definitive story of Elvis's early years. It's the first in a projected two-volume biography. Guralnick says he wants to rescue Elvis from his detractors, his admirers, and the dreary bondage of myth. Terry spoke with him in 1994. They started their conversation with the story of Elvis's first recording. When Elvis was 18, hoping to get discovered, he went to the fledgling Sun Studio in Memphis, where, for $3.98 plus tax, you could make your own record. This is the one he made.
Evening shadows make me blue. When each weary day is through, how I long to be with you. My happiness, every day I reminisce, dreaming of your tender kiss, always thinking how I miss my years. It seems I've gone by since we shared our dreams, but I'll hold you again. There'll be no blue memories then.
Elvis recorded this hoping that it would give him an in at Sun Records. He wanted this to be his audition. So what did Sam Phillips, the founder of Sun Records, have to say when he heard what Elvis had done?
Pretty much nothing. Not at that time. I mean, I think on Elvis's part it was an unrealistic hope. And what he got out of it ultimately was he got a two-sided acetate. The other side was That's When My Heartaches Begin. And he went home with it and he played it himself. His parents played it. I'm sure everyone marveled at it. He played it for his friends, and he stored it away eventually. What this probably led to was a revamping of his thinking, and all through the fall of 53, he continued, at least as Marion Kiesker remembers it, and Marion Kiesker was Sam Phillips's assistant, the office manager at Sun Records. And Marion recalls him coming in over the fall, and Sam also has memories of Elvis over the succeeding months. He came back in again in January of 54, made another acetate, and again nothing happened. And it wasn't until the spring of 54, I think until May of 54, that he finally got a call from Sam Phillips. And this came about as a result of both Marion Kiesker and Sam Phillips noting about Elvis, that he was a good ballad singer, and that maybe someday, and I'm sure this was also promoted by Elvis's return visits to the studio just to check in, see what was going on, but each of them had noted that Elvis was a good ballad singer, and eventually he got a ballad called Without You, which he had picked up at the Tennessee State Prison over in Nashville. He didn't have a singer for it, and he called Elvis back in.
And so Elvis comes in because Phillips thinks that he has the right voice to record this ballad, and then Phillips doesn't like the way Elvis sings it.
That's right. And again, the interesting thing in terms of this whole issue of cultural theft is that the ballad that he recorded does not resemble in the least anything to do with black music, the African-American tradition. It may very well be a black singer who is singing it, but it could as easily be Dennis Day as the Ink Spots. And Elvis's attempts at it haven't been preserved, at least not as far as anyone knows. But it was obvious that they didn't get anywhere with this ballad. Sam evidently asked Elvis to try other songs. Elvis probably threw in every song he knew, which were mostly, but what he sang for Sam that day was almost entirely ballads. It would be Dean Martin's songs by Dean Martin, songs by Billy Eckstein, songs by the Ink Spots, but nothing, again, nothing whatsoever resembling rock and roll. And I think at the end of the day, there was a feeling of great frustration on Elvis's part. I mean, just terrible disappointment. And on Sam's part, there remained the kernel of the idea that this kid is different. He has a different sound. There may be something. What is there? You know, there's something there that can be gotten. And out of that, Sam put him together with Scotty Moore and Bill Black, and said, "Why don't you guys try something with him and see what happens?"
Scotty Moore, the guitarist, and Bill Black, the bass player.
That's right. Yeah.
So the three of them come back into the studio, and they ended up, instead of doing more ballads, they end up putting out a single that on one side has Blue Moon of Kentucky, which was a Bill Monroe tune, something out of bluegrass, and on the other side had That's All Right, a kind of rhythm and blues thing by Arthur Crudup. How did they end up with that selection, considering Elvis had been pegged as a ballad singer?
I think nobody was more surprised than Sam Phillips, Scotty Moore, or Bill Black. I mean, they came to this out of sheer desperation, I think, on Elvis's part. Elvis met Scotty. He went over to Scotty Moore's house on a Sunday, Sunday, July 4th, as far as I can determine. On Monday night, they went into the studio. They really just ran through a bunch of songs. They ran through the same kinds of songs that Elvis had done for Sam Phillips in the studio previously. On Monday night, they went into the studio, and you can hear some of the early attempts, like Harbor Lights or I Love You Because, which were just pure ballads. Eventually, they were brought out years later by RCA. But it was evident by everyone's account that the session was completely falling apart. They were no more on the verge of success than Elvis had been in his initial tryout. And they took a break, and I think it was just in a moment of sheer desperation that Elvis, everybody's drinking Cokes, and all of a sudden Elvis just starts flailing away on the guitar and singing That's All Right, Mama. When Elvis started playing That's All Right, Scotty and Bill fell in and started playing along, and I'm sure it was very ragged, but Sam Phillips opened up the control room door, and he said, "What are you guys doing?" And they said, "I don't know." And Sam said, "Well, whatever it is, let's back up and do it again."
Well, let's hear Elvis doing That's All Right.
Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, Mama. Just any way you do it, that's all right. That's all right, Mama, anyway do. Well, Mama, she done told me, Papa done told me too. Son, that gal you foolin' with, she ain't no good for you. But that's all right, that's all right. That's all right, Mama,
I guess you really have to give Sam Phillips credit for hearing what it was that made Elvis Elvis and not trying to fashion him into, you know, somebody else's mold.
I think you have to give Sam Phillips enormous credit, not only for hearing, which is unique enough in itself, but for waiting.
Right,
For not imposing himself on Elvis or on Elvis's style. This is really at least a two-tiered story and probably more, because I think that Scotty and Bill had a great deal to contribute as well. But the thing is that Elvis was a person of such broad musical intelligence. He was someone of so many different musical interests. Marion Kiesker described how, on the first acetate, he went through 12 different styles in the course of one song, and I think you can hear him straining on some of the ballads that came out from those sun years. You just hear all these different voices and all these different gropings, in a sense, towards his own style. It was with That's All Right and Blue Moon of Kentucky, and then rolling on from there, you can hear someone discovering his own voice instantly. It's almost as if it came to him instantly, and it was his voice. It was not the voice that Sam Phillips, there was no imposition in it. Mm-hmm. It was not Sam Phillips saying, hey, you should record a blues, but it was Sam Phillips waiting until that moment happened and then saying, that's it.
My guest is Peter Guralnick, author of a biography of Elvis Presley called Last Train to Memphis. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Peter Guralnick, the author of Last Train to Memphis, The Rise of Elvis Presley. In your book, you really treat Sam Phillips with enormous respect.
Yeah, I think it's one of those remarkable accidents of history that a person of such unique talent as Elvis should be thrown in with a person of such equally unique gifts as Sam Phillips. I mean, you have really the meeting in Sam Phillips, you have someone who's as close to a genius as anyone I've ever met, and you have a person of just unswerving vision and dedication to the music. What's also interesting about the Elvis Presley story is that when Colonel Parker comes into the story, you have a person of an entirely different kind of genius, but you have someone who, in terms of entrepreneurship, in terms of marketing, in terms of is as focused, as driven, and as single-minded as Sam Phillips was with respect to the music, and you had an enormous conflict.
Colonel Tom Parker had already entered the record world by the time he took over Elvis's contract. What did he see in Elvis? What did he want Elvis for?
I think he saw him as a phenomenon that was happening. He witnessed it. He set up a tour early in 55, and he saw the phenomenon happening on that tour. He saw Elvis taking the show from his star act, Hank Snow, whom he was managing exclusively and with whom he was in a booking agency partnership. He saw the thing building. And just as Sam Phillips had recognized the potential in terms of music, just as Sam Phillips had recognized the musical potential, Tom Parker recognized not just the sales potential, but the phenomenological potential. I mean, this thing was happening in a way that nothing had happened before, and it was happening with a speed that nothing had ever happened before, at least not in his experience and not in most people's experience. So from late spring of 55, he was clearly in the picture in terms of trying to wrest the management contract from Bob Neal and get the recording contract from Sam Phillips.
When Parker brought Elvis to RCA, how did that change his sound?
It changed his sound a great deal, only because nobody at RCA knew how to record him. The Colonel had no interest in music. I don't mean to say he had no interest in music. I think he was a passionate advocate of Elvis in every way. And if Elvis had recorded in Lithuanian, the Colonel would have sought the best way to record Lithuanian Lithuanian language records. But it's a mistake to see him as influencing Elvis's sound per se. What really influenced Elvis's sound was that Sam Phillips had evolved a method, and he had also worked out a way of of pushing Elvis, not pushing is perhaps the wrong word, but of either inspiring Elvis or creating a climate in which Elvis could find his own voice and find his own style. At RCA, Steve Scholes was the person who essentially signed Elvis to RCA. Steve Scholes was almost he was a person who noted down the times. He was an A&R person. He suggested songs, but most of the songs he suggested Elvis found inappropriate. And he didn't have either a great deal creatively to contribute to Elvis, nor did he know Elvis, which was a very important point for somebody who sought reassurance. I mean, Elvis sought reassurance. He was looking for some form of approbation, and Steve Scholes didn't have it to give.
Peter, I'd like you to choose one of the RCA sessions that Elvis recorded that you think shows something about what changed for him at RCA when Sam Phillips wasn't around to help Elvis keep discovering his Elvisness.
I think a good example, and it doesn't have anything to do with the technical side, is his recording of Blue Suede Shoes. I'm sure that the reason that he recorded it was because it was such a huge hit for Carl Perkins. RCA was nervous that they had signed the wrong artist by getting Elvis rather than Carl, and probably this was Steve Scholes' idea. But the thing is, if you listen to the recording that Elvis did, which I loved at the time and continue to love, it never gets the groove. He never gets past the point. It's taken too fast. It's evident, as Elvis later said, that he simply didn't feel that he could beat Carl Perkins' version. But more than that, it just never grooves in on that inner, that you listen, for example, on the Million Dollar Quartet, and you hear him talking about Jackie Wilson's version of Don't Be Cruel, and he sings it over and over and over and over again. And I think that's how he heard a song, was just by he would hone in on it. And with Blue Suede Shoes, it stopped several steps too short.
Why don't we hear Blue Suede Shoes?
Great.
Well, it's one for the money, two for the show, three to get ready, now go, cat, go, but don't you step on my blue suede shoes. Well, you can do anything but take me over my blue suede shoes. Well, you can knock me down, step in my face, slander my name all over the place. Well, do anything that you want to do, but not, honey, lay off them shoes. And don't you step on my blue suede shoes. Well, you can do anything.
When Elvis started producing himself at RCA after his early sessions there, what changed for him?
What changed, I think, was that he was driving the session. It was at the July 2nd, 1956 session that produced Hound Dog and Don't Be Cruel that he really took over the reins for the first time altogether. And the thing was that I think that it was at this point that he was given... directions may be the wrong word, but he was leading the musicians. He was suggesting where he wanted to go. He was suggesting voicings. He was saying, when Steve Scholes said at the end of Take 18 or something that, I think we've got it now, Elvis said, no, let's keep going, and he went on for 31 takes. He allowed his own artistic vision to take precedence for the first time, and essentially, here he was at 21. He was running his own sessions.
Why don't we listen to Don't Be Cruel?
Okay.
You think this is a good record for him?
I think that for the first time he was, at RCA, he was singing in his own voice. I think that it's very different than the Sun records he made. It's much more of a pop record. But this was the direction in which he had been looking to evolve from the moment he first stepped into a studio. So that while it may not be as much to my taste as Mystery Train, say, it's a moment in which he's discovered his own Elvis voice once again.
You know I can be found sitting home all alone. If you can't come around, at least please tell the phone. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. Baby, if I made you mad for something I might have said, please don't forget my past. The future looks bright ahead. Don't be cruel to who heart is true.
waking up. Don't stop the hanging.
Your book ends with Elvis in the army, boarding the ship that's going to take him overseas to Germany. And there's a lot of press and fans and so on there. In fact, let me play a little bit of a press conference that I held right before he set sail.
Here at the Brooklyn POE, where Elvis Presley, Private Elvis Presley of the United States Army, is due to embark for Germany today. And let me tell you just a little of what the hubbub is like here. We've been, as I say, waiting for the past 2 hours for Presley to come in. There was some delay with his train. Now Elvis moves over and is going to sit down behind the desk. The microphones will be brought in. More pictures will be taken. Elvis apparently enjoying the whole thing very much. He's been in smiles since he walked into the room.
I'll starve to death, sir.
Is there a question back there?
I beg your pardon, sir.
Maybe we have that gentleman.
If rock and roll music were to die out, which I don't think it will, I would try something else. I would really probably go in for the movies then. I would try to make it as an actor, which is very tough because you got a lot of competition.
Peter, would you describe to us a little bit about what that day was like for Elvis?
It's a perfect example of the dutiful Elvis carrying out his sense of behaving correctly in public while feeling utterly forlorn and lost inside. I think there was a sense on his part, his mother had just died. Here he was on display. He's feeling as if, as he has told many of his close friends, he feels as if his career is gone at the moment of greatest triumph. The most terrible things have happened to him. And yet here he is on stage in front of all these people, all these adults, who really don't particularly wish him well, presenting a smiling, dutiful exterior image, saying all the things that he should say, never breaking his composure, never breaking, and expressing his patriotism and a sense of duty. It's not simply a remarkable performance. I mean, it expresses some of his very best qualities, and it also expresses some of the qualities which, in a sense, crippled him.
Peter Guralnick speaking with Terry Gross in 1994. His book, The Last Train to Memphis, is the first in a projected 2-volume biography of Elvis Presley. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Blue moon, blue moon, blue moon, keep shining bright. Blue moon, keep on shining bright. You're gonna bring me back on my baby tonight. Blue moon, keep shining bright. I say blue moon,
major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
D2WB1293, take one.
Tell my baby. Yeah, something like that.
Coming up, Elvis Presley's drummer DJ Fontana and his guitarist Scotty Moore talk about life with the king of rock and roll. And film critic John Powers reviews Copland.
Well, Lordy, 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 Miss Claudia, gal, you sure look good to me. Well, please don't excite me, baby. No, it can't be me.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. We continue our tribute to Elvis Presley with archive interviews with two members of his band, drummer DJ Fontana and guitarist Scotty Moore. Moore just released a new album, All the King's Men, which features DJ Fontana on drums. We'll hear from Scotty Moore later in the show. DJ Fontana was the drummer on Elvis's recording of Hound Dog. He played with Elvis early in his career and performed on many of his most successful records, also on his 1968 network TV special. Terry spoke with Fontana in 1987.
DJ Fontana, I want to talk with you now about your early days in rock and roll. You were Elvis Presley's drummer from about 55 to 69.
Yeah,
Before we talk about those days, I want to play one of the most famous recordings that you were featured on with Elvis Presley, and everyone's going to recognize this.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, you're crying all the time. You ain't nothing but a hound dog, crying all the time. Well, you ain't never caught a rabbit and you ain't no friend of mine. Well, they said you was high class.
That has to be one of the most famous drum rolls in history. Did you have that one planned?
We didn't ever plan anything. We never knew what was going to happen from one second to the other. And we'd go in the studio, just we'd kind of piddle around and find things, you know. And that just one of those things that just accidentally happened. There was no reason for it. I decided to put it in there, and he said, hey, that's great. Do it every time, you know.
I want to ask you about the Ed Sullivan appearance that you and Elvis Presley were on, the TV premiere, national TV premiere of Elvis Presley. And we've all heard about how the camera people were told to just shoot him from the waist up.
They said that, but I didn't see any sense in it, and I don't think anybody...
What were you told behind the scenes about that?
They said it was vulgar, his gyrations, but he really didn't do anything. I'm not comparing to what they're doing now. He was a saint, you know. But the press, you know, they'll write anything that people tell them, and then you got the churches behind you, so you had to just really kind of behave yourself, you know. But Elvis wouldn't have done anything to hurt anybody's feelings or the country or anything else, and he didn't think it was wrong. He really didn't think it was wrong.
You were one of the first groups to perform in front of a lot of screaming people. I think you had a lot of screamers long before the Beatles did.
Yeah, that was quite a few years back.
How did that affect you as a drummer? You must have had to play really loud.
No, not really. He always worked us tight. Everybody was right up against each other. It was hard to hear a lot of times. But I know one time we worked the Cotton Bowl in Dallas. There was about 45,000 people. And back in those days, that's a lot of people. And we really couldn't hear him do a thing. And he took his microphone and went way out to the gate, to the fence. And we were like in the middle of the arena on the 50-yard line. So we was probably 75, 100 foot from the fence. And we couldn't hear a thing. And he couldn't, I'm sure. We only had three little pieces. But we knew by his movements, his hands, his feet, legs, we knew exactly where he was. So we had to watch him awfully close to find out where he was all the time.
So some of those swiveling hips were probably cues to the
band.
It was
cues. When I was 15 years old, I was working strip acts down in Shreveport. So I learned to follow these people. So when he done all his moves, I learned to follow him because then I'd know where he was at.
He started becoming very famous when he was very young. And the individual members of the band were not nearly as well-known or as recognizable as he was. Did that cause a gap between the players and
No, the reason for that, back in those days, that's the way it was done. Except if you had a trio like Paul and the guys, you know. But we were like musicians. He was the leader. He was the boss. So we did what he never did. It was no boss sidemen relationship, but that's the way we felt about it. He was the star. We were just would compliment anything he could do. We'd try to help it out.
You appear in two of my personal favorite Elvis Presley moments. One is in Jailhouse Rock.
That was a good movie.
It was a great movie. Yeah.
I enjoyed doing that movie.
And also you were in that terrific 1968 network special.
With the black suit.
Yeah, he's wearing all leather and denim, as I remember.
It was hot.
the costume was hot, or the studio was hot?
The costume, that suit looked like it weighed 100 pounds.
Oh.
It was black leather. I mean, he was...
It was tight.
I don't see how he didn't pass out, really. And of course, with the lights and everything, made it hotter.
What was exciting about that special, though, was that it was a period when you thought, well, maybe he'd lost it musically. Maybe he was just going to be doing bland pop songs.
Well, he was worried about it. He was really, really concerned.
About how he'd...
How
what kind of reaction he'd
go
get.
Over, yeah, because he had been doing movies for 10 years. And when you do movies, your people are played to applause and clap and, you know, raise cane. You know, that's part of the job. So then he was a little concerned, and we went back to the dressing room. We was talking about it, and he said, what do you think? I said, hey, go out there and do the same thing you've done for years and get the people on your side. He had a knack for doing that. He knew how to, as young as he was, even in his earlier days, he knew how to get the people on his side somehow or another. I said, go out and do the same thing you've been doing for 15 to 20 years. He said, you think it'll work? I said, why not? You know, we were just talking about it. He said, I'm a little worried about it.
He got involved in so many excesses, and I'm not just thinking about, you know, drugs and food and things like that, but also excesses in music, show business excesses, big orchestras,
oh, well, that's
elaborate
when he,
costumes.
Yeah, well, that's when he went to Vegas. You know, that's showbiz there. You know, I don't think he was real comfortable at it.
Did you leave him before that?
Yeah, I left him. They wanted us to go to Vegas, but I really didn't want to go. Scotty had a studio.
The guitarist.
The Jordanaires had about 40 sessions lined up that particular time, so it was hard for them to all get away. And I hadn't been in Nashville very long, so I said, well, I'm going to stay here. I had two boys to raise, like Paul. You know, we had families by then, so I said, I'm going to stay home and try to get in on the recording end of it. So that's what I did.
So you didn't want any part of the Vegas stuff?
No, I didn't. We had been to Vegas in 1957, I think, and I don't know, it's just another world out there. You know, we'd have had fun, I'm sure, you know, and I'm sorry I didn't go now, you know. But still, I've been doing that for 25 years, you know.
DJ Fontana was Elvis Presley's drummer in the 50s and 60s. Terry spoke with him in 1987. Coming up, Elvis's first guitarist, Scotty Moore. This is Fresh Air.
Make it again!
Scotty Moore, the self-effacing musician who was Elvis's first guitarist and first manager, played with Elvis from 1954 through the 60s. As Peter Guralnick writes, guitar players of every generation since rock began have studied and memorized Scotty's licks, even when Scotty himself couldn't duplicate them. Scotty Moore has collected memories of his years with Elvis in a new book called That's All Right, Elvis. And he has a new CD called All the King's Men that also features drummer DJ Fontana. Terry Gross spoke with Scotty Moore last month. She asked him to share some memories about the 1955 recording session of Mystery Train.
It was a slow R&B song.
Junior Parker had recorded before.
Yeah, and we ended up just getting the tempo up more, and I changed the rhythm thing around. And I've always loved it. It's just a fun thing to do. I still use that as playoffs and stuff on things I do.
Now, did you and Bill Black work out the rhythm on this, or was this a groove that you just happened into together?
Well, Bill would just naturally, he was naturally fall in, slap bass, and, you know, put the rhythm in there. He might not hit every note dead on, but that rhythm would always be there. We always went for feel.
Mm-hmm.
If it felt good, if it was some little bobble or something, note wasn't quite true or something, it didn't matter. Because once you get that feel and you keep trying, it'll just go downhill. You reach that peak and it's gone.
Okay, well, this is Mystery Train. Elvis Presley, my guest Scotty Moore on guitar.
Coaches long.
long black train. Got my baby and gone. Train, train, coming round, round the bend. Train, train, coming round the bend. Well, it took my baby, but it never will again.
If you're just joining us, my guest is guitarist Scotty Moore, who we just heard on Mystery Train, and he's written a new autobiography called That's All Right, Elvis. When did you start realizing that Elvis was really catching on in a very emotional way with his fans?
I would say that after we did the first couple of TV shows with Tommy and Jimmy Dorsey,
mm-hmm.
after we went to RCA, before that, most of our shows and stuff had been all in the Southeast, and there had been some, granted, that starting to see the hysteria and so forth, but it really didn't come home to us till we did those shows, that national exposure. Then it just seemed like the floodgates opened up, you know.
Now, how did you feel about this? On the one hand, it was like really good news for the group that the singer was so popular. On the other hand, he was getting so much of the attention. Did you feel envious of the attention that he was getting?
Oh, no, that never even crossed our minds. No, that we hoped would mean bigger paychecks, bigger paydays, you know, for everybody.
Did it?
No. No, it did grow a little bit, but not very much. That's kind of what I'm saying with the title of the book. The pay raises, the perks and stuff, as it got bigger and bigger, didn't come along for the band, and I'm just saying that's okay. It's not. We're being paid a fair wage as far as a man on the street with an everyday job.
Right.
You know, $200 a week back then wasn't bad at all. But then you take, as he got bigger and we had to get in these bigger hotels, and people expect you to take them to dinner, and we bought our own clothes and paid our own hotel bills out of what we were making. We were saying, you know, hey, something should come from some other source, you know. I mean, that's was the thing. We weren't really arguing about that we didn't have enough to pay the bills at home, but it was all this other stuff that was really expected of you that you couldn't afford.
What would you say is your most copied guitar solo from the Elvis records? Or one of the most?
Probably Heartbreak Hotel, maybe. I don't know. I've never been asked that before. Can we do a survey? Write in, folks, and tell me. I don't know.
Well, why don't we go for Heartbreak Hotel?
Okay.
Tell me your memories of this session.
Well, of course, that was the first one on RCA. And they were trying to get basically the same sound that Sam was getting, had gotten with us in Memphis. And they had this big, long hallway out in the front that had the tile floor. So they put a big speaker at one end of it and mic at the other end and the sign, do not enter. And they used that. That's where it ended up with that deep, real room echo instead of the tape delay echo that Sam had used. Now, there is, it's hard to hear, there is a little tape delay on it, but either their tape machine didn't match his, so it's just very slight, and then he ended up with the acoustic echo. And I'll give them credit, maybe they didn't think about it, but a room echo at that point was sound effects they used in the movies. They weren't using them for recording. And then here comes this, and it's so drastic. But it worked for the song. When you say, you know, at the end of Lonely Street, it's so distant. And I like to say this, if you don't mind, that in speaking of these technical things, one thing that Sam did that I don't believe he realized when he was doing it, and I didn't until years later, that I got into engineering, he pulled Elvis's voice back close to the music. You know, all the Sinatra and all those things where the voice is so far out in front. And he more or less used Elvis's voice as another instrument.
Into the mix.
Even to the mix. But didn't bury him like a lot of the rock things, you know, later.
Right.
But closer.
Now, your solo on Heartbreak Hotel, is that something you had prepared before the session, or is this something you had worked out?
No. Everything we ever did was just spur of the moment.
Did you learn the song at the session, or did you know it before that?
No, learned it at the session.
Well, all right, let's hear it. 1956, Heartbreak Hotel.
Well, since my baby left me, well, I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of Lonely Street, that Heartbreak Hotel where I'll be just so lonely, baby. Well, I'm so lonely, I'll be just so lonely, I could die. Although it's always crowded, you still can find some room for broken-hearted lovers to cry there in the gloom. I'll be so lonely, baby. I'll be so lonely. I'll be so lonely, I'll make it die. Man, the bellhop's tears keep flowing, and the desk clerk's dressed in black. Well, they've been so long on the street, they'll never look back. And think you're so lonely, baby. Well, they're so lonely. Well, they're so lonely, and they could die. Well, if your baby leaves you, you've got a tale to tell. Well, just take a walk down the lonely street to Heartbreak Hotel, where you will be. Well, you'll be just so lonely, baby. Well, you'll be lonely. You'll be so lonely, you could die.
Heartbreak Hotel, my guest Scotty Moore on guitar, and he's written an autobiography, which of course includes his years playing guitar with Elvis Presley. It's called That's All Right, Elvis. Did you see Elvis undergo a personality transformation as he became more and more famous, you know, a recording star, a movie star, a heartthrob, an icon?
You know, the years I spent with him, he seemed to take it in stride.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I saw all the things changing around him, you know, with the movies and such. And he became more secluded as he gathered his entourage around him because he didn't feel like he could go out and didn't want to cause a scene, you know, and just going to, you know, like a famous restaurant or something. But as far as personality changes and stuff, I didn't become aware of any until after I left him, and then he started in the 70s. And I don't know the inside, and I've heard, of course, and read a lot of stuff, but it still amazes me because just a few months before he died, I saw some footage, and when he was so bloated, and I said, there's something desperately wrong. Because he was very vain, and there's no way that he'd go out in front of people like that.
Did you feel like
I don't think he could see himself in the mirror at that point.
Did you feel like you didn't recognize the person he had become?
No, I didn't.
Did you communicate with him at all during that period?
No, and it was not because of any conflicts or anything. It's just that with this entourage around, and there was two or three of those guys that were really good guys, but still, he could call me a lot easier than I could get through to him. You know what I'm saying? I make the call, you know, if he ever gets it or not. And so I just left it for him.
But he did not call them.
You never know what he's being told.
Right. Tell me, you know, in the years after Elvis's death, there have been cult groups that have risen around him, people who swear that they've seen him even though he's been dead and so on. Everybody knows what I'm talking about. What goes through your mind when you see the way even in death he is worshipped? mean, you know him as you knew him as a man, not as a god.
Yeah, well, he would. They're misguided. You don't want to be sarcastic, say, you know, get a life, but it's okay to like somebody, but don't idolize them like that, you know. And he wouldn't have liked that. He really wouldn't. And he didn't like being called a king either.
He didn't?
No. He said there was only one king, and there was a man upstairs.
Do you feel bad that Elvis died during a period when you weren't really in touch, so you didn't have a chance to maybe talk about things with him that you might have liked to talk about before he passed?
Well, yes, in one way, but in another way, he was so vain, I could never see him growing old gracefully.
Huh, that's interesting. But like you were saying, if he was so he was so vain, and yet he managed to allow himself to balloon the way he did.
That just astonishes me. Yeah. I don't know. I'll never understand that.
But you can't imagine an aging Elvis.
No, I mean, if he hadn't got into that
right.
situation, no, I never could. In fact, the guys, we used to talk about it, you know, said, what's he going to do when he gets about 60, you know? What if he goes bald, you know, just all kind of stuff like that.
Well, Scotty Moore, I'm really glad you're playing again. And a pleasure to have the chance to talk with you.
Terry, it's been a pleasure and enjoyable.
Guitarist Scotty Moore speaking with Terry Gross last month. Coming up, a review of the new film, Copland. This is Fresh Air. Ever since John Travolta resurrected his film career in Pulp Fiction, movie stars have been using small independent films to help change their image. The latest to try a makeover is Sylvester Stallone, who moves out of the action hero business in his new movie, Copland. John Powers has this review.
Back in the 60s and 70s, Hollywood was fond of making movies like The Longest Day or The Towering Inferno that tried to convince viewers they were seeing something special by filling even the smallest roles with well-known faces. Every time you looked in a foxhole or opened an elevator door, you'd see somebody like Richard Burton or Robert Vaughn acting his head off. The new movie Copland practices the same overkill. It's an essentially small film, almost crushed by the weight of its cast. The scene is Garrison, New Jersey, a small town dominated by off-duty New York cops who, in a classic case of white flight, have taken their families out of the city and tried to create a small, safe utopia across the bridge. These cops control everything, including the local sheriff, Freddie Heflin, played by Sylvester Stallone, who let himself get pudgy for the role. The overweight Freddie always dreamed of wearing NYPD blue, but he could never make it because he was deaf in one ear. And so he wound up in Garrison, dealing with speeders and treed cats, and doing the bidding of Harvey Keitel's character, Ray Donlan, a crooked New York cop who essentially runs the town. Even when an internal affairs detective played by Robert De Niro asks for his help, Freddie tries not to see what's really going on. But eventually, things get so out of control in Garrison that he's forced to start acting like the real sheriff he always yearned to be. Of course, when Freddie and his deputies start doing their jobs properly, the locals don't like it. At one point, Keitel gets stopped for speeding by Freddie's deputy, Cindy, who's played by, of all people, Janine Garofalo.
Hi, can you turn your engine off for me?
I got the air on.
You on the job?
No, we're coming from Forest Hills, honey. I'm John McEnroe, that's Jimmy Connors.
Is your license in there? Can you pull it out for me, please? This is a school zone.
Listen, Miss Betts,
You're new, right?
Yes, I'm new here, but I'm not new on the job. I was a municipal deputy in Elmira.
Freddie! See, Officer Garrison, when the car you're going to tag has got a PDA sticker, I'd advise you to think to yourself, hey, that's one of the good guys. I think I'll go catch me a bad guy.
Copland was written and directed by James Mangold, who's come up with a clever, sharp script. I'm tempted to call it an Eastern, because Mangold has so obviously transported to New Jersey the themes of the old Hollywood Western. You have the beleaguered sheriff who needs to prove himself. You have the town run by evil gunmen who spend their time at the local saloon. You have the flawed sidekick, in this case a cokehead cop, nicely played by Ray Liotta. And naturally, you have the final showdown out on the streets. Although this is the purest formula, it's a formula that still works. We want to see how Freddy will redeem himself. But while the movie holds us, that's all it does. We keep expecting it to kick into high gear, but Mangold's directing lacks the confident snap of the best westerns or crime pictures. His first movie, Heavy, was a clumsy little number about an overweight pizza cook. It had the cramped look and feel of a low-budget independent film. So does Copland, which unfortunately is an expensive movie, crawling with famous actors that Mangold's not able to control. The worst offender is Stallone, who's like a black hole at the center of the movie. After years of playing action heroes in rubbish like Judge Dredd and Daylight, he's obviously hoping to humanize his image with Freddy, whose sweetness and underdog vulnerability hark back to the character who made him, Rocky Balboa. But in the years since Rocky, Stallone's ego has grown larger than a head on Easter Island, while his acting has grown far less expressive. Freddy should be a can't-miss role, but Stallone's talent has been so corrupted by success that he can't play an ordinary guy anymore. He's clearly forgotten what it's like to be an outsider looking in. And so, rather than make Freddy a man of feeling and depth who regains his pride, he shambles through the movie seeming faintly half-witted, like Lenny in Of Mice and Men. There's nothing behind those Basset Hound eyes except infinite vanity and his desire for our love. He's living in Starland, not Copland.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Today's show was produced by Danny Miller, Roberta Shurrock, and Monique Nazareth. Our director was Alan Tu. It's back to school for our summer intern, Deborah Witkus. Thanks, Deb. All the best next semester. And it's back to work for Terry Gross. She'll return Monday. I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publishers of The God of Small Things by Arundhati Roy. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the truth about cats and dogs. We talked to cat expert Roger Tabor about felines. He's written a new book, Understanding Cats. Then, how to deal with a problem pooch. We talked to Dr. Nicholas Dodman, author of The Dog Who Loved Too Much. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.